Path. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. Today's interview was recorded 7 days ago. And I am deeply appreciative of the opportunity to be speaking for the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with a writer by the name of Hope Jaron. And perhaps you know her from a highly acclaimed previous book called Lab Girl. Her latest book is called The Story of More, How We Got to Climate Change and Where to Go from Here. Hope Jaron now makes her home in Norway, but she is actually someone who was born and raised in the Midwest. And she has been teaching and speaking about the environment and the well-being of our planet for a long, long time. And much of what she has explored over the years has gone into the writing of this very, very powerful book, in which, in a relatively short amount of time, she nevertheless manages to explore really every facet of our planet's well-being. She is a geobiologist, and her previous book, Lab Girl, was all about, first of all, the life of plants, but also just the way in which we are all connected and the great joys that are experienced when one looks at the world around us through the lens of science. This latest book, The Story of More, is published by Vintage. And Hope Jaron, via telephone, joins us from her home in Norway. Hope Jaron, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. It's really great to get a chance to talk to you and your listeners as well.
I'm happy that we have this opportunity. We, of course, are recording this interview on the 20th of March, and both of us are living in a very different world, a world that feels very different thanks to this COVID-19 crisis. I wonder if we could just hear from you about what life is like in Norway, to what extent you and the citizens of Norway are touched by this situation and the way in which your country is confronting this crisis.
It's interesting. We are all in our homes, and we are encouraged not to go out except to buy food or to go to the pharmacy. There are some places that are open. There's no rules or threats, you know, saying, you know, if you're found out cavorting about something bad will happen. But people are very, very mindful of the suggestions that have been laid out, because, of course, nobody wants contagion to be worse than it is. Let's see. So I'm on day 8 at home. 8 days ago, it was March 12th. They closed all the schools, and that means all the way from daycare through the university, and that's where I work. And we were told sort of at 4 o'clock that by 6 o'clock we should be home, take anything we wanted with us. There wasn't really a plan for how to work from home or how to do online teaching. It was pretty much agreed upon that the most important thing was to get everybody to a lifestyle that would minimize contagion and address the spread of the illness. So it's been about a week, and we're all kind of figuring out how we're going to make our workplaces work and our schoolrooms work from home with the benefit of all the digital ways there are of reaching across space and time. And that's about it. I'm sure things are different where you are, but we're probably, we're kind of all in this together, but separately, as they say.
Right.
So I imagine perhaps folks in Wisconsin are trying to minimize the amount that they go out and have contact, and many of the same things that we're looking at over here.
Absolutely. I wonder if we could actually talk for a moment about the potentially positive consequences of what we are experiencing, not so much in terms of how we can battle future contagions with lessons learned from this particular crisis, although if you want to say something about that, you're welcome to. But I guess I'm thinking more in terms of the context of your book, The Story of More, the ways in which we are seeing ourselves and the planet differently because of what we are all experiencing right now.
Yeah, I know what you're trying to say. There's nothing positive about this. You know, people are ill and dying, and so there's absolutely nothing positive about it. And I don't mind saying that I'm a praying person, and so, you know, what I pray for is that this is over, and the threat of illness and death ends. Now, after that happens, we will have a lot of things to talk about. One of the things that we will have to talk about is how we made different choices during this time, and how a lot of those choices really resulted in us using less energy. So some of the things that we were doing every day turned out to be optional when it came right down to it. And that, I think, has the potential to transform how we go forward and, are some of those optional things gonna remain optional in our minds? That's gonna be the really interesting thing to talk about. But, of course, that's down the road when, all these shadows have passed.
Tell our listeners a bit about how this book took shape and what prompted you to write it.
Well, that's a simple story, really. I turned 50 this year, and it got me thinking. I wrote Lab Girl because my life didn't really make sense, you know. First of all, writing a book is a really selfish thing. You've got to do it for yourself because that's all that might ever come of it. You know, you write a book, you don't know if it's going to get published. It gets published, you don't know if people are going to read it. People read it, you don't know if they're going to like it, right? So you better do these things for your own sense of accomplishment. So what I wanted to do with Lab Girl is I was trying to figure my life out. You know, I had this strange life. I'd lived all these different places, and I knew some stuff about plants, and I had these kind of weird friends, and I'd been in these kind of car accidents and stuff, and none of it made sense, right? And then I took the time to sit down and write it all out as a story, and all of a sudden it was, my life was a story with a beginning and a middle and, I mean, kind of an ending. And that was what I got out of that. So then I started looking at turning 50. And, of course, there's not going to be Lab Girl 2. There's not going to be Lab Woman, mostly because, you know, I don't live like that anymore. You know, I learned my lesson on some of that. I drive more carefully, and I have a much much less interesting life in some ways, and so does Bill, of course. And but I started thinking about what about this time? You know, what has it meant to be alive for 50 years on this planet, for these 50 years? Not the 50 years that came before me, and not the 50 years that will come after. These 50 years have been mine. What does it mean? And so I sat down at the computer and I started to catalog how things have changed, you know, how every database I could find, you know, the Environmental Protection Agency and the USDA and the, you know, the Norwegian fish monger newsletters and the U.S. Census reports and, you know, Department of Energy reports and World Health Organization, everything I could find. And just looking at the numbers, without expectations, really, of, you know, how has food production changed? How has energy use changed? How has, you know, how has the urine output of the city of St. Paul changed over the last 50 years? Just everything I could get my hands on. I did that for a couple of years, and I started to see patterns. And I started to see a pattern that explained this half century to me. And I wrote it out as best I could and as clearly as I could. And now it's time to put it out in the world and see if it resonates with other people.
We're speaking with Hope Jaron about her book, The Story of More, How We Got to Climate Change and Where to Go from Here. The book is actually about much more than climate change. It is really about every facet of our planet's well-being, and in particular, the way in which our planet has changed over the course of the last 50 years, since 1969. You tell us in the first chapter of the book, titled Our Story Begins, about something that a Norwegian explorer said about the thinning ice at the North Pole, observations which were dismissed by many, and observations which turned out, as you say, to be somewhat right, but also wrong in some respects. I want to take just a moment to have you explain what you go on to say from there, which is this: we should not be surprised when scientists are wrong. All human beings are a lot better at describing what is happening than at predicting what will happen. Somewhere along the way, however, we began to hope that scientists were different, that they could be right all the time. And because they're not, we kind of stopped listening. And by now, we're quite practiced at not listening to things scientists say over and over again. I think you're touching on something extremely important right here, and it provides some very important context for what your book is about, and also the way in which all of us need to be treating the testimony of the scientific community. Tell us more about your concerns around this.
Well, I, you know, there's a lot of science books out there. There's a lot of books on climate. And, you know, I used to go into bookstores and the books are up past my eyebrows. And I think, why does Hope Jaron need to write another book? You know, there's plenty of books in the world. And I always came back to the idea that I didn't like the voice that I found in scientific writing. I didn't like, you know, to me it sounded like getting a lecture or even getting a sermon sometimes. It didn't sound like somebody talking to me who respected me as somebody just as smart as they were, who had simply walked a different path, who had simply spent the years that they spent in a lab, you know, raising kids or driving materials around or milking cows or, you know, a bunch of other stuff. And I wanted to write that way. I wanted to write science with respect for people that I was certain could understand it just as well as I could if they were told and explained. Well, explain is kind of a yucky word, but if they were told the story in the right way. That was my challenge. And so I've done a lot of thinking about where we've gone wrong, you know, because scientists have come up with some interesting things, and we don't seem to be able to bring those ideas out and get any traction, not just, you know, making people do what we think is the right thing to do, but getting those ideas into people's dinner parties, you know, and family night in between rounds of Uno and stuff. Why aren't folks talking about, you know, the latest results for climate change and this sort of thing? Well, I think there's faults on a lot of sides here. I think one thing that went wrong early on was the decision or the tendency or the style or whatever it was to call this global warming. There's reasons why that makes sense. You know, ever since people have known that carbon dioxide is a gas, and this was back in the 1800s, soon after they figured out how to isolate that gas, they noticed that when you put sunshine through it, it heated up. So the idea that carbon dioxide filling up the atmosphere and making the Earth hot, that has been around since like the 1800s. People have expected that to happen. Now, I think scientists thought that it would be simple and sort of palatable to say global warming. So the Earth is going to heat up because of this. What would have been better, and what we hear now, and what I hope people will consider, is the idea of global weirding. Because the atmosphere doesn't, of course, work like, you know, those simple experiments in the lab. What you get is a parcel of air heats up, and then it pushes other parcels away. And folks that listen to the weather understand that, right? High pressure system coming in, a low pressure system leaving, you know, that builds up to a storm, you know, or a weather change. Sometimes it gets hotter, sometimes it brings in a blizzard, etc. What we're seeing now are, you know, these weird storms, these weird winters, these weird freezes. We're seeing warming, but we're just seeing a lot of odd things happening here and there. And that's consistent with what we should have gone with, which was weather weirding, which reflected a more sophisticated look at the atmosphere, which I think we underestimated the public's ability to appreciate. There are faults on all sides.
In the opening of the book, you are exploring matters related to exploding population, and not just the sheer numbers of people on the planet, but also where we live. And also the fact that something like children's mortality has drastically come down, which of course is something for which we are all grateful. But it's also one contributing factor to the escalating numbers of people that we are seeing on our planet. You explore a lot of interesting things in this portion of the book, but I want to give you a chance to talk about what is perhaps the single most intriguing connection that you make between escalating populations and gender inequality. You see a very powerful connection there and say that the most effective and long-lasting mechanism for curbing global population growth revolves around an elimination of gender inequality. How are these two things connected?
Right. Well, I always have to. Science is absurd, right? I mean, it's really, sometimes it's just really funny to listen to scientists talk to each other, and nothing is more absurd than if you look at the last several thousand years of discourse about population growth. I mean, ever since people have been able to count each other, there have been people totally freaked out about population growth. Like, you can look at the writings of Mesopotamia when they were really freaked out about, you know, the population getting above 100,000 people or something for the Earth. And all the way through, you know, you find this in medieval writings, you find this in whatever. And you know, as you go, of course, population has continued to rise all the way through this. You also find people bitter about population increase, and it's almost as if they don't realize that they're a product of it, right? Like, that's why you're standing here? Like, are you really arguing for the fact that that shouldn't have happened? So people kind of think population increase is something that happens, bad people having too many babies somewhere else or whatever. And I would even go further to say that, mostly it's males or male colleagues that are really, really upset over population growth. And I actually, turning back to feminist theory, I really think it's one more of the many neuroses about our inability to control female fertility from a male perspective. But that's probably an entirely different show. If you look at... So if you want population to level off or get lower, it could happen by terrible mechanisms, by illness or a terrible draconian methods that take away people's self-agency. Or what you see in many, many countries is that population rate goes way down and growth becomes actually plateaus when you get when you close the gender gap, when you make opportunities for financial participation, political participation, and educational participation on par between men and women within a society. And that's not just in, wealthy countries. If you look at the data on that, when you see that opportunity is similar for men and women, you see that the size of families is low. I think it just turns out that when women have, full control and agency over their lives, they will not choose to have more children than they can take care of. And the average will become somewhere around replacement. But you never hear that. You never hear that posited as an approach. But it's really glaring if you look at the data that is what is highly correlated with low rates of population growth.
Right. And as I said, this section of the book is replete with all kinds of fascinating observations about population growth and particularly the way in which people in escalating numbers are moving to larger and larger cities. The second part of your book takes up from there with the matter of food and how we feed all these people and the challenges involved in that. But I want to return to a point about that you actually make in the first part of the book when you're talking about escalating population. At this point in time, you're quoting someone by the name of Henry George, who wrote on some of these topics back in the 19th century. And you tell us that Henry George was right when he said that most of the want and suffering that we see in our world today originates not from Earth's inability to provide, but from our inability to share. It is because so many of us.
I'm saying you're
reflecting something that Henry George first said. But yes, these are your words.
No, those are my words. Henry George said that more people would undoubtedly give rise to more helpers, more people to help produce food, and more people to help produce what shelter and what is needed. And that's what we've seen. We've seen that this doubling in population over the last 50 years, over my lifetime, population has doubled. But food production has tripled. Meat production has tripled. Grain production has tripled. Sugar production has quadrupled. And fossil fuel use has also tripled, right? And those two things are linked, right? Because you plow fields and you drive food around and you drive animals around, etc. So we've had this tremendous growth in population, but we've far outpaced that in terms of what we produce in terms of both food and energy.
And in this section then called Food, you explore some of the most important changes that have occurred, including in the farm fields of Minnesota where you grew up, gigantic increases in yield, which at a simple glance would seem like an entirely good thing. But of course, there is a dark side to that massive increase in, for instance, the yield of grain in our farm fields. Explain why this is so worrisome.
Well, so to get a bushel of corn, and a bushel is about what it sounds like. It's been in use for 1,000 years. It's about as much as a big basket, weighs about 50 pounds, about the biggest thing you could check in when you get on an airplane at the airport. So to produce one bushel of corn, back when I was born, it used to take a field about the size of a basketball court. And nowadays it takes just over a parking space worth of land in order to get that much corn. So we've done that in a few different ways. We've altered the genetic makeup of the corn itself. We've improved the herbicides and the fertilizers that we apply to these fields. And so fertilizer and herbicide use has gone up tremendously. And we've also now got these kind of designer crops that aren't available everywhere. You can't save, you know, your seeds from what you planted last year. You've got to buy seeds in order to keep up with these high-yield varieties. So we've kind of turned the seeds of the food supply into a technology that's for sale. And it's in the hands of just a couple of corporations. So we've taken a lot of agency away from our farmers and turned what used to be kind of family businesses into part of a much larger corporate sort of structure.
Right.
Let's see. The other question is then what do we do with all this grain? I mean, we actually grow so much corn in the United States that there are questions. Well, we've got to find something to do with all this. Far, far more than we can cram down our throats. So about 10% of the corn that's grown in the United States is eaten, you know, in the form of corn chips or corn on the cob or anything like that. About half of what's left goes to feed animals, which we then eat. And the other half of what's left we turn into fuel. We turn into ethanol, and we put it into our combustion motors to drive around. So, which, when you think about it, I think is really kind of the height of absurdity. We take fuel and we use it to plow fields so that we can grow food, and then we take the food and transform it back into fuel, and then I suppose we use some of that fuel to plow the field, to plant the corn, to turn into fuel, et cetera, et cetera. So it's kind of this environmental Mobius strip. And the other thing that's come of corn is that we've turned it into sugar. We found a way to turn it into sugar and squirt it all over everything. I mean, it's in your ketchup. It's in your soda. It's in your, you know. So, and that was yet another sort of desperate measure to find something to do with all this excess corn. And, of course, that has changed our diets completely and made them almost unbearably sweet. So our sugar consumption has gone up, you know, by 4 times or whatever since 50 years ago. So there are all these things that you know, you might not feel like that cornfield is linked to your gas tank, is linked to your convenience food, is linked to your Coca-Cola, but it actually all comes together under this umbrella of more. It all has to do with this wild increase, this doubling of people, but tripling of everything else, quadrupling of some things, etc.
Right. I want to give you a chance to speak briefly on something you say in the chapter called Raising Meat. And this was a chapter I read with great interest as somebody who loves meat and consumes more meat than I should, and just about all Americans consume more meat than we really should for a variety of reasons. But the concern that you raise so persuasively in this chapter is about the tremendous investment of resources that are tied up in the production of meat, that it takes so much in order to give us all of the meat which we consume. And you make a case for the fact that if we consumed less meat, it would mean so much more for others. Explain that equation and why it is so crucial.
Right. So it takes, so what we kind of call these concentration factors. So you have to feed an animal, and it varies between different types of animals, but you have to feed, a rule of thumb is you have to feed an animal about 10 pounds of grain to get 1 pound of meat. From that 10 pounds of grain, right, you get 1 pound of meat, you get several pounds of poo-poo, and you get a lot of it burnt off by, you know, the animal has to move around and vocalize and grow and all those kind of things, and it burns food the way you and I do. And so when you use grain to make meat, you lose most of that grain. Right now with meat, we are kind of stuck in this almost religious attitude towards it. You know, sort of, are you a vegan? Are you a vegetarian? Are you a meat eater, whatever? And I try to encourage people that you don't have to. You know, if the entire, what we call the OECD, which is North America, Europe, Japan, Australia, and New Zealand, if those countries put together went to, you know, one meatless day a week, you could increase the grain supply for the world by something close to 20%, right? So there's a space in between being a vegan and eating so much meat, it's, you know, giving you poor health, right? So, you know, there's a big difference between meat 3 times a day and meat 1 time a day. There's a big difference between meat 1 time a day, 7 days a week, and meat 1 time a day, 3 days a week, right? So, and these, you know, you're playing with these big concentration factors. So, and this is, you know, for better or worse, this is where we are in America, is that small changes in our lifestyle add up to big savings in terms of basic resources.
Yes.
Simply because we are the capital M on the more.
The next part of your book is about energy, and I want to be sure that you have a chance to talk about a wonderful assignment that you give every single semester to the students in whatever class this is that we're talking about, but something in which they have to observe through the course of the day each and every time they use electricity. Explain why this is such a helpful exercise that probably all of us should do.
Yeah, that's one of my hopes with the book, is that people will become more aware of when they use energy. What I kind of argue with the book is that over the last 50 years, it's not just the tools that we use, it's the landscape of our life that has come to require energy. Right, it's stuff that we don't even think about. You know, our toothbrushes are electric now. You know, we no longer rake leaves. We blow them around with something with an engine in it, right? So all these daily activities that we used to do with our muscles have been slowly and systematically replaced by energy-using machines that have been cheap to acquire, and so far they've been cheap to run, but it's really changed the facet of our daily lives. So I ask my students, you know, write down every time you use electricity. Most of them can't make it through breakfast. Most of them can't get out the door. And they get the obvious things like switching on the light switch and turning on the coffee maker and stuff like that, but they forget about the fact that you know, their iPhone has a battery in it, the hot water heater is plugged in or has a gas furnace. They forget that their battery is what starts their car, and that the green light at the intersection is part of the power that goes through the city. I think it's almost hard to go 5 minutes without invoking something that uses electricity, and most of our electricity the vast majority of our electricity goes back to the burning of fossil fuels. So your iPhone is run off of fossil fuels. You may not realize it, but that battery is charged using fossil fuels.
And this whole part of the book on energy proceeds to talk about all kinds of different ways in which we consume enormous amounts of energy, often mindlessly, and the way in which we are inflicting all kinds of damage on this planet. The fourth part is called Earth, in which you talk about the well-being of the air we breathe and the waters in which we travel and swim, the matter of temperatures, the matter of all kinds of other facets of life, including rising waters, extinctions of various species, which you explore in ways that bring all of this home without overwhelming us somehow. And at the end of this section, you explore the matter of hope. When people ask you, do we have any reason for hope? Your answer is, yes, absolutely. Explain where you find hope and where you would have the rest of us find hope in the midst of all of this.
I think it comes down to the way I was raised, honestly. I was always taught that love is a gift and hope is a duty, you know, and we are the portion of the world, we're the 10% of the world that made these problems. And so it seems like we shouldn't give up on the world that we compromised, right? I have a hobby now in that I watch Soviet-era movies. I just really like them because they have huge casts and stuff like that. But if you've ever watched the black and white version of King Lear, it's amazing, right? And then the director was this guy called Grigor Konstantinov. And he did this during, you know, the Cold War. He made this movie during the Cold War. And artists were disappearing right and left, you know, because sometimes they were making covert criticisms of the government or whatever. And somebody asked him in an interview, and it affected me really a lot. He said, you know, You were working under the everyday threat of personal annihilation. How did you keep from falling into despair? And he said that despair is a Western luxury. And I always thought that was so interesting. I think despair is the luxury that you have when you feel like the terrible things that are coming might not hurt you the most, right? Well, that's kind of a long answer. I mean, kind of a better answer is that I got an attitude of hope from my father, who had lived long enough to see a lot of changes in his life and a lot of problems solved. You know, he had been through polio, and you know, he had seen medical care increase greatly. He had seen cars replace horses. He had, you know, he'd lived to see video conferencing and things like that. And he always embraced, you know, new ideas and new changes as people learning new things and then putting that to work. He was also a teacher. And when you're a teacher, you see people change. You see them grow and become more confident and know more about the world and feel like they're part of it. And it just becomes your experience that people can change and that people can learn and that they can do things that they couldn't before. That's kind of the way life goes. And if you can help 30 people in a room do it, then why not expect that the whole world is doing that all the time and something good will come from it? But I don't know otherwise if I could explain hope. It's something to work at. I mean, I think I think, and I say this in the book a lot, that having hope requires courage. You know, hope is not just a gift somebody gives you. It is a duty, and it is what you work to make real. There's a great quote in the book by the poet, I think it's by Shelley, it's, you know, to love and hope till hope creates from its own wreckage the thing it contemplates. Which I think is so wonderful.
Absolutely. I want to mention that at the end of the book is a very interesting appendix called An Environmental Catechism, in which you spell out many of the sort of stark, raw statistics that are part of this 50 years that you chronicle in your book. There's also a very helpful appendix on sources and suggested reading for people to look at more information. And the first two appendices I'd like you to summarize, if you would, the action you take and the difference you make. What do people find there?
So I really believe this can be turned around. And even if the solutions come too late for some of us, it will not be too late for all of us. I think the first step is people understanding what their energy use is. I think that people have a lot of agency over their energy use. Not entirely, you know, people have to go to work and they have to feed their kids and things like that. But our energy use and our food use and food waste really is the summation of 1,000 little choices we make every day. And tweaking some of those choices and then some trial and error around, if I tweak them, can I tweak them further? You know, those can add up to some really big things. And then walking into your workplace or your house of worship and saying, you know, here's what I did in my life and here's how it turned out. And as an institution, is this something we can embrace? So I write this not from a policy perspective, because, you know, I have a lot of colleagues that have been calling for changes in policy for a long time, and it's not happening. You know, people are determined that that's the best way. You know, the carbon tax isn't getting off the ground, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so my book dares to take, people call me naive all the time, but I dare to take a hearts and minds approach, because I really believe that when people think differently, they act differently. And when lots of people act differently, the world changes.
Mm. I want to end with a quote from your chapter called Keeping the Lights On. As you are talking in this particular point in the book about energy, it echoes what you talked about earlier. All of the want and suffering in the world, all of it, arises not from the earth's inability to produce, but from our inability to share. Curbing consumption will be the ultimate trial of the 21st century. Using less and sharing more is the biggest challenge our generation will ever face. On that note, we end this conversation with Hope Jaron talking about her profoundly important book called The Story of More, How We Got to Climate Change and Where to Go from Here, a paperback from Vintage Books, a division of Penguin Random House. Hope Jaron, I thank you so much for writing this book, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. Very best wishes to you.
Oh, it was a pure pleasure to be here. So nice to talk to you.
And to finish out today's program, I want to read to you a portion of the second appendix from Hope Jaron's book, The Story of More. The second appendix is titled, The Difference You Make. It begins this way: making a difference as to global change is often about finding the biggest lever, figuring out where to stand, and then pushing and pulling like hell. For better or worse, as a member of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, you are part of the biggest lever in the world with respect to the issues raised in this book. Later on, she writes, this means that if you are a citizen of the United States or any of the other OECD countries, any steps you take towards austerity will have an outsized effect on global consumption. Let me give you an example. Let's say an examination of your values has led you to the belief that reducing carbon dioxide emissions is important. A fact-finding mission revealed that all of your household electricity comes from a coal-burning plant on the other side of town. Because at least 20% of the total energy we consume comes to us as electricity, you've decided to take action by cutting down on your home usage of electricity as much as possible. How to proceed? A good way to start is to discern the biggest lever in your home in terms of electricity usage. In the European Union, all new appliances are required to be sold bearing an ENERG sticker displaying several indices of energy efficiency. The critical value to look for is the number of kilowatt hours / annum, which is the estimated amount of electricity that the appliance will use over the course of 1 year while serving a household of five. By comparing this number between makes and models, members of EU countries can begin to choose and control the level of energy use in their homes. Some American companies, General Electric, for example, provide kilowatt hours per year estimates for selected products such as freezers and refrigerators. Additional companies could be lobbied to make this information more available. For most homes and apartments around the world, it is by far the electric water heater that uses the most energy. Having hot water usually amounts to about half the total electricity used in your home. If you're able to change from a 50-gallon water heater to a 20-gallon model and use cooler water or even cold water while washing clothes, rinsing dishes, taking showers, you can cut your water heater's electricity use by as much as half, meaning that you've now cut your total household electricity use by one quarter. The next biggest levers are the machines designed to heat large spaces and to cool them, that is, space heaters and air conditioning units. Together, they probably eat up another one-third of your electric bill. If you can tolerate a decrease in room temperature during the cold season and an increase during the warm season, you will save energy. Note that your air conditioner is the bigger lever of the two. When cooling a room, you must vent the hot air of the room into the even hotter air outside, and moving against entropy requires extra energy. An air conditioning unit will require about double the electricity of a space heater to achieve the same degree change in temperature in a given room. Can you go without AC for more days of the year? How much can you turn the heat down during the winter? In theory, with a fireplace and a fan, you could all but eliminate this heating-cooling lever. Now you've cut your total electricity use by 60%. The next biggest levers in your home are the objects that heat or cool small spaces: your clothes dryer, your stove, your dishwasher, and your refrigerator freezer. Altogether, they use about 15% of the total electricity in your home. Could you use them less often or run them at a different temperature? Admittedly, these are not strong levers, but every little bit counts. Ironically, your television, your computer, and the lights that brighten your home, things that you are probably careful to turn off when not using, contribute very little to your total electricity usage. You'd have to leave a 60-watt light blazing 24/7 for a whole year in order to approach the amount of electricity that your electric stove consumes off and on. For slobs like me, the bad news is that this set of weak levers also includes your vacuum cleaner. If you vacuum your house once a month instead of once a week, you've barely shaved off one-third of 1% from your total electricity use for the year. Nonetheless, by making all of these changes, you have now lowered your home electricity use by a whopping 70%. This lowers your tally from just over the average modern use in the OECD, 10 megawatts per hour per year, to the 1965 average of Switzerland that I keep harping about. If each of the 1.3 billion people in the OECD made similar sacrifices, it would lower global electricity use by 25% and lower fossil fuel use and carbon dioxide emissions accordingly. Maybe electricity use is not your thing. Maybe you are more concerned with meat intake or food waste or car commuting or airline travel or pesticide use. Regardless of your mission, start in your own home and expand from there. I promise you'll be surprised at how far abroad it takes you. A portion of the second appendix from Hope Jahren's book, The Story of More. I'm Gregory Berg. Thank you. on the morning show a newly recorded interview with a doctor from the Mayo Clinic, giving advice on how all of us can maintain our mental and emotional health through the course of the COVID-19 crisis. And in part two, from the archives, the author of a book called A Short History of the American Stomach, an examination of Americans' relationship to food. On Tuesday, a look back at an epidemic perhaps even more terrifying than COVID-19, the polio epidemic of the early 1950s. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at Carthage.com.